vision, or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Claudia, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the October 15th issue of the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Wall Street soars as trading deals rise. Big banks' earnings beat forecasts with the help of markets and boardrooms. Deal-making, trading, and corporate lending are gaining steam and fueling profits at the nation's biggest banks, with Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan Chase, Citigroup, and Wells Fargo all beating third-quarter profit and revenue forecasts. Goldman is now on pace for its best year ever in its main investment banking and markets division. JP Morgan is on track to make more than $50 billion in annual profit for the second year in a row. BlackRock is sitting on a record $13.5 trillion in assets under management. The strength is evident across many of the bank's businesses, reflecting the enthusiasm in the stock market and corporate boardrooms. Record high stock markets fueled increased trading and borrowing by hedge funds and others to buy even more securities. President Trump's policymaking is adding volatility that keeps traders eager to move, but not so much to spoil the punch. Financing activity is surging with mergers on the rise, and there are massive investments in the rise of artificial intelligence, building out data centers and other infrastructure. This year has seen the biggest ever leveraged buyout to take video game maker Electronic Arts private, advised by Goldman and funded by an immense $20 billion financing from JP Morgan. And Bank of America is expected to bring in the biggest ever disclosed deal fee for a single bank, a cool $130 million. We're in an environment at the moment where CEOs think that the opportunity to get things done strategically is possible, Goldman's chief executive David Solomon said. We have significant activity in the shop. Still, bankers are signaling that the good times might not last. Wall Street is booming as the U.S. economy is expanding, but it's subject to all manner of hard-to-read dynamics. Concerns about a slowing job market, the financial health of lower-income households, and potential asset bubbles are percolating. Volatility, trade wars on inflation could all return and slow the enthusiasm. The recent failures of two automotive companies, Tricolor and First Brands, have bankers and traders anxious about risks lurking. These are early signs there might be some excess, and if we ever have a downturn, you could see quite a bit more, JP Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon said. Goldman told employees that it would be launching another round of layoffs as part of a restructuring to grow more efficient. Despite the better-than-expected results, bank stocks initially slid on Tuesday. Trump's revival of the trade war with China on Friday sent stocks to their worst day in months, interrupting a long run of new all-time highs. Banks are typically hit hard when investors worry that the hostilities will drag on the economy. Tensions appeared to be calming midday on Tuesday after a slow start for the broader market, with the S&P 500 up around 0.3%. The index ended the day down 0.2%, and JP Morgan and Goldman both closed down around 2%. Goldman's investment banking revenue in the third quarter increased 42%, driven by advisory fees. JP Morgan and Citigroup's investment banking fees jumped 16% and 17% respectively in the quarter from a year ago. Fees were also up at Wells Fargo, which has been focused on boosting that relatively small business in recent quarters. Conditions have been kind of good, as you can hope for, JP Morgan's chief financial officer, Jeremy Barnum, said. The risk in deal making helped spur one of the busiest Septembers in debt markets that bankers could remember. Industry-wide, debit capital markets activity and lending to companies is surging, and Goldman's revenue from debt underwriting was up 30% in the third quarter from the prior year. Meanwhile, the banks benefited from a return of initial public offerings as startups raced to go public after years of quiet. Revenue from equity underwriting was up 21% at Goldman, 53% at JP Morgan, and 35% at Citi. Meanwhile, many companies move to refinance their existing debt this summer. Some bankers advise clients to refinance rather than waiting for interest rates to drop further, warning of the possibility for geopolitical or other macroeconomic factors to emerge in the next year or two. There's still tariff uncertainty out there. There's still inflation uncertainty, and obviously the prospect of slowing growth, Mark Mason, Citigroup's finance chief, said. I do think there is some preparation that's going into the activity that you're seeing. In the markets divisions, trading revenues have continued to hit new records in the post-pandemic period, and banks are profiting from lending to supercharge clients trading even more. J.P. Morgan's trading revenue rose 25%, while at Goldman it was up 12% from a year ago. In another sign of buoyant markets, investment management giant BlackRock reported its record assets after bringing in $205 billion in new client money, one of its best quarters ever. BlackRock's shares climbed 3.4% Tuesday to a record high. They are up 16.5% this year. Taking a step back, there is no question there's a fair amount of investor exuberance at the moment, Goldman's Solomon said. While I feel good about the forward outlook on balance, the market operates in cycles, and disciplined risk management is imperative. We are especially vigilant in times like these. U.S. shift against electric cars swells into a global reversal. The U.S. retreat from its electric vehicle ambitions is spreading around the globe. In Canada, Prime Minister Mark Carney paused an electric vehicle sales mandate that was set to take effect next year. And the UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer has allowed for a more flexible timetable to hit the country's EV targets. And the European Union last month bowed to pressure from automakers to rethink, a year earlier than planned, its 2035 target for eliminating carbon dioxide emissions from cars. There's this realization that, hey, this transformation isn't going as fast as we want, said Patrick Schaffus, a partner at consulting firm McKinsey & Company. EVs aren't smartphones. The reality is hitting hard in the U.S. General Motors. Said on Tuesday it would take a $1.6 billion charge due to sinking EV sales, a shift it blamed on recent moves by the U.S. government to end EV subsidies and regulatory mandates. The automaker has lobbied heavily this year to loosen electric vehicle requirements. That might just be the beginning of a financial reckoning from automakers that poured billions of dollars into new electric models, from sports cars and sedans to pickups and SUVs, to try to get ready for the government-backed EV mandates. Automakers have been saying that consumers aren't adopting EVs as quickly as expected, and government efforts to proliferate the technology are hammering their bottom lines. GM, in announcing its charge, said it's reassessing EV capacity and warned that more losses are possible. There is more realism that EVs are probably a good solution in the future, but it's not going to be forced down the throat of customers, said Christian Meunier, chairman of Nissan Americas, referring not just to the U.S., but to much of the Western world. It's pragmatism. Car makers argue the EV business model is a money-losing proposition, given still high battery costs, spotty charging, networks, and dwindling government subsidies. Incentive programs have ended or have been pared back across Europe and in the U.S. and Canada. Volkswagen, burdened with massive electrification costs, helped spur the reckoning in Europe when it said it would cut 35,000 jobs as part of a deal with its union. The move sent shockwaves through the region's political establishment. Weeks later, the EU launched a strategic dialogue with the automotive industry that led to a more flexible timetable for car makers to meet its emissions rules for 2025. Following another round of talks last month, EU Industry Commissioner Stephanie Sejourne said a 2035 target for cutting carbon emissions from cars to zero would be reviewed as soon as possible, according to a spokesperson. The lobbying effort from European automakers to water down EV mandates was in high gear at last month's Munich Auto Show, where they jostled with Chinese newcomers such as BYD, XPeng, and GAC to launch eye-catching new electric models. Jean-Philippe Imparato, the European boss of Stellantis, which owns brands including Fiat, Peugeot, and Jeep, said in an interview at the Munich show that he considers the EU's targets for 2030 and 2035 unreachable. Volkswagen CEO Oliver Blum called for a better charging infrastructure, cheaper electricity, and subsidies for entry-level vehicles. "We are still not there," he said. "You can't punish the automotive industry for something they couldn't influence 100%. The shifting landscape and the challenge it presents to automakers was in focus as Blum, who also is CEO of Porsche, showed off coming vehicles. He touted a family of small EVs designed to compete with new Chinese rivals in the company's home market. He also showed off the latest version of Porsche's 911 Turbo S sports car in a sign of the industry's renewed interest in internal combustion engines, particularly at the luxury end of the market. A policy note published before the recent EU talks enumerated the European car industry's continuing challenges, including higher tariffs on shipments to the US, low EV margins, and the rise of Chinese brands with a cost advantage. "We need to listen to the voices of the stakeholders that ask for more pragmatism in these difficult times," European Commissioner President Ursula von der Leyen said earlier this year. Before he was Canada's Prime Minister, Carney spent a decade advocating for the fight against climate change. By the time he took office this spring, Canada had a more immediate crisis. President Trump had levied debilitating tariffs on some of the nation's biggest industries, including 25% duties on cars, steel, and aluminum. Months of rising unemployment and GDP declines followed. Carney shifted from green-centric to laser-focused on bolstering the nation's economy. Last month, he paused an EV sales mandate set to take effect next year, a move aimed at easing an auto industry bruised by Trump's trade wars. "We're at the start of a restructuring in the Canadian auto sector," Carney said as he announced the decision, and the suspension of the EV mandate for 2026 is part of helping with that. Carney said officials would review the existing EV policy and look for ways to reduce costs and potentially bring more affordable EVs to Canada. Even China, the world's most dominant EV market, is showing cracks. Sales continue to grow, but increasingly at the expense of profitability as carmakers fight for customers in an oversaturated market. Consulting firm Alex Partners predicts that most of the 118 EV brands operating there in 2023 won't be viable 5 years from now. Where China has doubled down on EVs, Japan has largely avoided the tumult by pushing for vehicles that pollute less without requiring specific technologies. The country includes hybrids into government targets. In the EVs boom early days, Japan's Toyota Motor took heat for largely skipping EVs in favor of hybrids. Chairman Eiko Toyota at the time described himself as part of a silent majority in questioning the wisdom of the global EV push. Toyota instead focused on gas-electric hybrid vehicles, a technology it pioneered with the Prius. The reality check abroad is less dramatic than in the U.S., where EV sales have disappointed in recent years and are now expected to plunge after Congress and the Trump administration largely did away with federal support from tax credits for buyers to regulations requiring cleaner, more efficient fuel vehicles. GM, which until recently aimed to have all electric lineup by 2035, and the U.S. industry's main trade group successfully lobbied this year to take away California's ability to set its own tailpipe emissions standards. The victory effectively killed the country's biggest driver of EV investment. The U.S. also did away with fines for automakers that failed to meet federal fuel economy standards and a $7,500 tax credit for electric car buyers. In the U.S., Alex Partners now predicts EVs will make up 18% of new vehicle sales by 2030, half of what it expected 2 years ago. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. New York City's office market sees prices roar back. New York City's office market is enjoying its biggest boom in nearly two decades, leaving the rest of the U.S. in its dust. Businesses leased 23.2 million square feet of additional Manhattan office space during the first 9 months of 2025, according to real estate services firm CBRE Group. That is the largest amount of new workspace rented for that period in 19 years. A combination of factors is fueling the recovery from more New York workers heading back to the office regularly, to the financial sector's increasing appetite for more modern office space. Accounting and consulting company Deloitte signed one of the biggest leases this year when it rented nearly three-quarters of a new Hudson Yards skyscraper under development on Manhattan's west side. Technology, media, and advertising companies also gobbled up space this year, extending a recent run. Amazon.com, for one, expanded its New York presence by purchasing a Fifth Avenue building and leasing an additional 330,000 square feet. New York is setting the pace for the rest of the country. Manhattan leasing activity in 2025 has now surpassed its 2018-2019 levels. Nationwide office leasing remains about 11% below its pre-pandemic average, according to CBRE. Competition for prime space in Manhattan has grown so intense that many large tenants have to choose between a great location or a top-quality building. In most other cities, landlords only wish that they had that kind of problem, said Michael Slattery, CBRE's research director for the New York region. Manhattan developers are moving ahead with more than a half a dozen new office projects, the most at any point since the pandemic. They are encouraged by a record 143 leases signed so far in 2025 for more than $100 a square foot, already more than the total number signed at this level in 2024, CBRE said. The city's office market resurgence owes much to the continued strength of its financial services sector, a core engine of the city's economy. Even as the broader U.S. economy shows signs of slowing, major banks are expanding payrolls to handle a rebound in deal-making and initial public offerings. New York also offers strategic advantages. Business districts from the Financial District to the Park Avenue corridor near Grand Central Terminal offer suburban workers a relatively easy train commute, and the city's return to office rate is the highest in the country. In July, office attendance in New York was 1.3% higher than it was in July 2019. That was tops among the 11 business districts tracked by Placer.ai. Nationwide, the return to office rate was still 22% below 2019, the firm said. New York is especially attractive to the younger workforce that many employers are trying to attract. The city this year ranked first among U.S. metropolitan area for attracting college graduates, according to a JLL report that analyzed close to 1.5 million new graduates entering office jobs. Early in the pandemic, New York was among the lagging group of gateway markets, said Jacob Roden, JLL's senior manager of U.S. office research. But in late 2021 and early 2022, that narrative started to shift. New York's office market is far from fully healed. Manhattan's vacancy rate stands at 14.8%, according to CoStar, nearly double the 8.2% recorded in the final quarter of 2019. Many of its older and undistinguished buildings are obsolete or facing financial distress. New York City office landlords also are bracing for next month's mayoral election, which Democratic nominee Zoran Mamdani, a Democratic socialist, is expected to win. Many real estate executives worry his proposed rent freeze on rent-stabilized apartments and his plan to increase taxes on the wealthy will hurt the industry. What would disrupt New York's recovery would be if we had an unwelcome climate for business and entrepreneurs, developer Gary Barnett said. Still, Barnett is developing a new office building by Grand Central Terminal that already counts IKEA as an anchor retail tenant. Nearby, JPMorgan Chase's recently opened Park Avenue headquarters is the most talked about office tower in years. The $3 billion 60-story skyscraper includes 19 food operators, outdoor gardens, and meditation rooms. Other corporations and their clients and employees are going to want a more comparable experience, said Owen Thomas, chief executive of office developer BXP. It's elevating the expectation of what an office can be. BXP reached a tentative deal to lease one-third of its Midtown office development that is underway to global insurance and investment firm CV Star, according to people familiar with the matter. Thomas declined to comment. Beyond the gleaming new towers, New York is experiencing a recovery in its lesser quality office stock. New York's so-called Class B buildings have clawed back about 10% of the 25 million square feet of occupancy they lost during the pandemic. 5 times the national rate of recovery for similar properties, CoStar said. Many troubled and obsolete office buildings are finding new life as housing. Spurred by new city and state policies, Manhattan is going through one of its most active waves of office-to-residential conversions since World War II. Every neighborhood in New York is becoming a mixed-use neighborhood, said developer Marty Berger, who is leading a group that is converting a mid-block tower near the Empire State Building in Midtown. To China, stock market is Trump weak spot. In its trade standoff with Washington, Beijing thinks it has found America's Achilles heel, President Trump's fixation on the stock market. China's leader Xi Jinping is betting that the U.S. economy can't absorb a prolonged trade conflict with the world's second largest economy, according to people close to Beijing's decision making. China is holding a firm line because of its conviction, the people said, that an escalating trade war will tank markets as it did in April after Trump announced his so-called Liberation Day tariffs, prompting Beijing to hit back. China expects that the prospect of another market meltdown ultimately will force Trump to negotiate an unexpected summit with Xi late this month, the people said. Beijing continued playing hardball this week, escalating the trade fight Monday by sanctioning the U.S. units of South Korean shipping giant Hanwha Ocean. The move whipsawed U.S. markets Tuesday, triggering a sharp early sell-off as hopes for easing tensions faded before major indexes partially rebounded and steadied in the afternoon. Last week, Beijing imposed sweeping restrictions on the export of rare earth minerals, which are vital to consumer electronics and the tech industry. Trump then threatened additional 100% tariffs on China starting November 1st. Both sides have vacillated between tough talk and de-escalation in recent days, but the rhetoric took a harder turn Tuesday. China's Commerce Ministry accused the U.S. of double standards regarding tariff threats and vowed that China would fight to the end in the trade dispute. On social media, Trump said the U.S. is considering terminating business with China on cooking oil and other elements of trade because of China's refusal to buy U.S. soybeans, a decision Beijing has said is retaliation for Trump's own tariffs. Trump frequently wields the market as a real-time barometer of his economic stewardship. He has taken to social media to trumpet record market highs, crediting his administration's policies. Conversely, when the market has faltered, particularly in response to his aggressive trade policies, he has tended to retreat or float the prospect of new deals. While Trump hails the strength of the U.S. economy, Chinese officials see weaknesses that would worsen during a trade war, with hiring slowing, manufacturing contracting, and prices rising. Many economists say the U.S. is in position to absorb another major trade fight with China. The market's new sharp negative reaction Friday to China's new rare earth restrictions and the potential U.S. retaliation served as a reminder of the economic vulnerability Beijing seeks to exploit. China's own economy has been in a protracted downturn, weighed down by a collapsed property market, ever-rising debts, and weakening consumer confidence. However, Xi is far less beholden to market swoons, even though the Chinese economy faces a precarious outlook. Speaking to reporters Tuesday at the White House, Trump projected a mix of his usual stated personal affinity for an open confrontation when addressing the trade disputes with China. I have a great relationship with him, Trump said before quickly adding, but sometimes he gets testy. Acknowledging the severity of recent Chinese actions ranging from its new rare earth export controls to the latest shipping-related sanctions, Trump said, we have a lot of punches being thrown. Beijing softened its tone Sunday after Trump reacted furiously to the rare earth restrictions, but its de-escalation appeared to be a tactical pause. According to the people close to Beijing's decision-making process, hardline strategy is based on the belief that Trump will ultimately fold and offer concessions rather than deploy Washington's own significant leverage. This confidence was fueled, the people said, by a U.S.-China trade truce struck in May. Trump had imposed tariffs of more than 100% on Chinese products, but relented after Beijing used its leverage as the world's most important exporter of rare earth magnets. It is precisely China's belief that Trump will fold, as he appeared to do on magnets earlier this year, that have led them to massively escalate, said Russ Doshi, a scholar at Georgetown University and the Council on Foreign Relations, who previously served in the Biden administration. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Gone digging, gold fever breaks out. 2 weeks ago, Mike Hewlett struck gold, sort of. The California welder has plenty of hobbies, including snowboarding, skiing, and dirt biking, but with gold prices reaching record highs, he's taken up a new one, prospecting. While hiking in a forest in the Mount Shasta area with a metal detector browsing over rocks and dirt, his machine began to beep. Hewlett had detected metal buried inside some gravel. Digging it up, he found a chunk of gold about half the size of his pinky finger. "I was jumping all around like you see in cartoons and stuff," the 50-year-old said. The nugget, which he later had weighed, wasn't exactly life-changing. It was worth $175, he said. But then again, it was just sitting out there to be taken. Across the country, a modern-day gold rush is underway. People on social media brandishing gold-flecked pans and nuggets while showing off their equipment, ranging from old-fashioned picks to gold-separating sluice boxes. Others trade tips and pore over maps, determined to figure out which areas could still hide metallic riches. The dream of stumbling on a mother lode might be far-fetched, but with gold prices reaching $4,000 an ounce, it's a tantalizing one. "The whole way I'm driving out, I'm thinking I'm going to pull out this freaking $100,000 nugget," said Hewlett. The Big Thunder gold mine in South Dakota has been inundated with requests for advice, said co-owner Sandy McLean. The gold mining museum, which contains a collection of artifacts dating back to the 1874 Black Hills gold rush, offers panning lessons and the chance to prospect on its land, finders keepers. Sessions have been selling out. Sales of their 5-gallon pay dirt buckets, which go for $55 apiece and contain local dirt, are up 50% from last year. People will take it home and sit in their garage with a tub from Walmart and pan it, said McLean. In her 33 years of owning the museum, she's never seen such fever. Like gold rushes of yore, the surest path to making money often comes from selling mining gear. In a more modern twist, there's also a social media gold. The biggest YouTube accounts devoted to prospecting boost more than 500,000 followers. In Sacramento, Cody Blanchard, age 35, had been gold hunting for several years in Northern California before starting his own business selling equipment and offering prospecting tours last year. He's personally found around 6 ounces, but the business, a side gig for the sanitation worker, has proven more profitable. On some days, Blanchard will nip over to a local park with a metal detector in hopes of finding lost gold jewelry, but when he has more time, he prefers snorkeling in riverbeds where he chisels into bedrock. He said the thrill of that first gold find in the wild can't be beat and keeps people coming back. It's like a heroin addiction, he said. Sometimes gold hunters stumble on other finds. Once when Blanchard was out prospecting with friends, they found old buttons from Levi's jeans dating back to the mid-1800s. They still had some denim attached. 2 years ago, while Chris Spangler was camping with his family in the Mojave Desert and digging for gold by night, one of his children looked up and realized they were surrounded by hundreds of tarantulas. They were apparently drawn by vibrations from their equipment, including a dry washer and a generator. It was kind of freakish, but at the same time, it was something you'd never otherwise experience, said Spangler, a 39-year-old healthcare administrator for the U.S. Navy, now based in Sydney. He's been chronicling his family's whole gold hunting journey on social media, where he has a combined 430,000 followers. Their social media presence has earned the family around $30,000, eclipsing any gold they found. In many countries, small-scale gold mining is a way of life, said Parker Shanabel, an Alaska-based gold miner who stars in Discovery's long-running Gold Rush series. By contrast, in the U.S., he notes, stronger environmental regulations can make it harder for people to do much extraction. But soaring gold prices are helping change that calculus, he said, especially given how financially strapped many Americans feel. That's one of the things that's very cool about gold mining and why there's a TV show about it, said Shanabel, age 31. You can get very lucky and happen to find life-changing amounts of money if you stumble on the right spot. Gold fever comes with a serious symptom, competition. Rising prices have drawn more people to the annual Goldzilla mining event at an Alabama campsite near the Georgian border, where anything found is split among the crowd, said regular attendee Justin Kennedy. The more people you got participating, the less gold you're going to get in your bag, Kennedy said. The campsite owner uses gold washing equipment that he custom built. Still, the mechanic, age 46, said the experience is fun either way. He plans to attend again this weekend and aims to turn the gold he's collected into rings for his wife and daughter. Every year, busloads of fourth graders flock to the Marshall Gold Discovery State Historic Park in Coloma, California, to learn about the state's gold rush and try their hand at panning using water in a trough that park workers seed with gold flakes. This past weekend, it hosted a reenactment of an 1850s tent town, complete with costumed actors. Though the price of gold has shot up, said senior park aide Cynthia Flewelling, they'll continue the activity, which costs $10 a head and includes a 15-minute lesson and half an hour to pan for flakes, which participants are allowed to keep. We're not going to be pikers about it, she said. Any kid who makes an effort gets a flake. Powell keeps Fed on track for another rate cut. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell left the central bank on track to reduce interest rates again at its meeting later this month by highlighting weaknesses in the job market despite lingering concerns over sticky inflation. Powell said the central bank is trying to balance against two risks that could call for competing policy steps. Cutting rates too quickly could leave the inflation job unfinished, but moving too slowly to reduce borrowing costs could spur painful losses in the employment market, he said Tuesday at an economics conference in Philadelphia. There really isn't a risk-free path now, since inflation appears to be continuing to increase quite gradually, but now the labor market has demonstrated pretty significant downside risks, Powell said. Both the supply and demand for labor have declined quite sharply. Separately, Powell hinted the central bank could be approaching the end of a more than three-year campaign to shrink a portfolio of Treasury securities that it acquired to provide stimulus after the 2020 pandemic upended the economy. The Fed has been passively reducing its $6.6 trillion asset portfolio since mid-2022, when these holdings peaked at nearly $9 trillion as part of an extraordinary effort to support financial markets and the economy. The process of reversing that stimulus has been draining bank deposits known as reserves from the financial system. The Fed has said it would shrink those holdings until signs emerge that markets are less flush with reserves. We may approach that point in the coming months, Powell said during a gathering of the National Association for Business Economics. Powell said little to push back against broad expectations that the Fed would cut rates at its coming meeting on October 28th and 29th, even though he said nothing to specifically ratify such expectations. He said the economic outlook hadn't changed much since the Fed agreed to cut rates at its meeting last month. Since a lapse in the federal funding on October 1st, the Fed has been operating without access to the first-tier government statistics that it uses to refine its economic outlook, which in turn guides decisions on where to set rates. We'll start to miss that data, Powell said. If the shutdown persists, evaluating how the economy is performing could become more challenging. Data available before the government shutdown suggested economic activity might be on a somewhat firmer trajectory than expected, he said. Powell devoted much of his speech to indirectly defending the central bank against a litany of critiques lodged in recent months over the Fed's conduct on monetary policy since the 2020 pandemic, including by Treasury Secretary Scott Bessnett and by several candidates who could succeed Powell as Fed chair when his term ends next May. IMF sees global growth slowing. Tariffs, inflation, and other threats such as eroding central bank independence are all clouding the world economic outlook, the International Monetary Fund said in its latest round of projections. The IMF said the global economy is on pace to grow by 2.6% this year, measured on a fourth quarter versus fourth quarter basis. That is down from a projected 2.7% in its July forecast, and a slowdown from 3.6% growth last year. Growth is projected to rebound next year to 3.3%, a tenth of a percentage point more than projected in July. U.S. growth is now likely to slow to 1.9% this year, better than 1.7% the IMF projected in July, but down from 2.4% growth recorded in 2024. Next year, the IMF sees 2% U.S. growth. So far, the U.S. has been spared the worst consequences feared when the Trump administration rolled out historically steep trade barriers in April. The White House has delayed or backed down from many of the measures, and agile planning by businesses helped many stock up on overseas goods ahead of time. A flood of artificial intelligence investment, booming financial markets, and the promise of Federal Reserve interest rate cuts have all helped, too. But the weakening U.S. labor market, above-target inflation, surging government debt levels, and a more fragmented landscape driven by protectionist attitudes around the world show the potential problems ahead, the IMF said. Trade war risks were on display last week when President Trump threatened an additional 100% tariff on China in response to new Chinese export restrictions on critical industrial minerals. The uncertainty for businesses and consumers from such headlines indicates how the trade war has weighed on the American economy, even though it hasn't tipped into a recession, said Pierre Oliver Gorinchas, the IMF's chief economist. Compared to our expectation a year ago, what we're seeing very clearly is less growth and more inflation in the U.S., he said. On the latest tariff threats on China, he added, the flare-up last week is an example of these things that can resurface very quickly and affect the outlook. The IMF's forecasts were prepared before those tariff threats landed. Meanwhile, the U.S. shutdown has left policymakers without much of the official economic data they rely on. It adds to concerns around America's economic institutions following the administration's broadsides against the Fed and the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Such challenges aren't limited to the U.S., Gorinchas said. He noted that as a long list of countries struggle with high debt burdens, more governments could be tempted to pressure their central banks to lower interest rates and juice the economy. In the U.S., spending on AI infrastructure has been a strong economic boost. If AI turns out even more valuable than investors now expect, U.S. growth could surpass expectations and a hot economy could revive inflation, Gorinchas said. But if the technology disappoints, a big investment pullback and falling share prices could lead to a serious downturn, he said. To find workers, hospitals train teens. Health systems are joining with high schools to create employee pipelines. Ballot Health has a $70 million problem. Like many rural hospitals, the Tennessee-based health system struggles to recruit workers, forcing it to pay traveling nurses tens of millions of dollars every year to fill the gaps. It also thinks it has a solution: train more local high school students to join its ranks. The idea is catching on elsewhere, too, as a health system struggle to find enough workers to care for an aging population. Nationwide, hospitals are confronting a shortage of everything from aides to doctors that has strained many wards and emergency rooms. Even as the labor market has softened, healthcare jobs have stayed plentiful. People spend on healthcare in good times and bad, and thus far the ability to change bedpans and insert IVs hasn't been automated. Human resources advisory firm Mercer projects a deficit of 100,000 healthcare workers by 2028, mostly among nursing assistants, while the aging population drives up demand. Ballot is trying to create a local labor pool by working with five Northeast Tennessee school districts to train teenagers. The first batch of 200 students will graduate in 2029 with their licensed practical nurse credentials and be eligible to work right away at Ballot, earning $23 an hour. Our intention is to employ them, said Ballot Chief Executive Alan Levine. The program is also a stepping stone for students who want to pursue more advanced medical training, which Levine said Ballot would help pay for. Conditions have improved since the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, when Ballot lost nearly half of its bedside nurses. Still, it had to pay $70 million in the last fiscal year to bring in traveling nurses, who are costlier than those on staff even after hiking pay and benefits. The shortage is acute, Levine said, adding that it leads to longer patient wait times in both emergency rooms and other care settings. Ballot is getting help from Bloomberg Philanthropies, which last year announced it was pumping $250 million into 10 programs in states, including Tennessee, Texas, and North Carolina, to create a high school to healthcare pipeline. Another healthcare-focused high school, the Northwell School of Health Sciences in New York City, also just launched this school year with 240 students. More efforts are taking root in other states and cities, too, as hospitals tap local schools to try to solve their worker shortages. These moves are part of a larger shift back to vocational education in the U.S., fueled by a desire among educators to get students started sooner on career paths that interest them. Labor-strapped industries are eager for the help, while many students have grown skeptical of pricey college degrees. College is a very expensive career exploration program, said Brooke Rice, Vice President of Curriculum and Work-Based Learning at NAF, an education nonprofit, that in 2013 launched a high school curriculum focused on teaching students about healthcare careers. That program now serves around 18,000 students at 100 high schools around the country. For Emma Smith, 15 years old, enrolling in the Ballard Nursing Program was a no-brainer. I get a kickstart on my career, said Smith, a sophomore at Greenville High School in Eastern Tennessee. Smith now spends hours every week in a classroom with mannequins and hospital beds, in addition to taking classes including Spanish and AP English. She plans to use her credentials from Ballard to start healthcare work while she also pursues a college degree to become a labor and delivery nurse. In the Houston area, the region's growing population also fuels the need for more healthcare workers, said Brian Sisk, chief nursing executive at Memorial Hermann Health System. Their health education and learning high school, which opened at an existing Houston school last year, lets students choose career paths such as medical imaging, physical therapy, and pharmacy technician roles. By the time they graduate, students will have spent 220 hours doing clinical rotations inside Memorial Hermann's facilities and will be eligible for jobs there. Starting salaries range between roughly $40,000 to $80,000 a year. Demand quickly exceeded available slots at the school, which currently enrolls 309 students. All my middle school years, I really didn't like going to school. I hated it, said Brianna Castillo, a sophomore at the high school who hopes to become an ultrasound tech. Now, though, the 15-year-old said she's eager to show up because she believes it will help advance her career. Research suggests that students who enroll in classes with a focus on career and technical training tend to perform better academically and have higher attendance rates. In some ways, the new high schools are a throwback to the days when hospitals ran their own nursing programs, as they did a half century ago, said Janet Kaufman, a professor at the Institute for Health Policy Studies at the University of California, San Francisco. Hospitals have closed many such programs in recent decades, in part to save money, she said. Filling nursing jobs isn't the only challenge. Bi-State Health, a Western Massachusetts-based system, also uses a high school career program it has run since 2006 to find new recruits for jobs, such as respiratory therapist and sterile processing technician. Many participants have gone on to pursue additional training, and more than 900 have ended up working for Bi-State in the past decade. A lot of these careers are very attainable, but people don't know about them, said Peter Blaine, Bi-State's workforce development manager. At the brand new Northwell School in New York, students pick from four career paths in their sophomore year. They will get workplace credentials in fields such as pre-nursing and healthcare management. You can't sit and wait to see who shows up, said Michael Dowling, the former CEO. Man gets 25 years for fire at Governor home. A judge sentenced the man who set fire to the Pennsylvania governor's residence, forcing Josh Shapiro and his family to evacuate, to 25 to 50 years in prison. Cody Ballmer, age 38, from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, pleaded guilty to state charges of attempted murder, aggravated arson, burglary, and other charges under a plea deal. He won't be eligible for parole until April 13th of 2050. In April, Ballmer breached a fence to access the property and forced his way into the mansion. Authorities said he confessed to throwing Molotov cocktails inside the residence. Shapiro on Tuesday detailed the emotional toll the attack has taken on him and his family. It's hard for me to stand before you today and utter the words attempted murder when it's your own life, he said. To know that someone tried to kill me, it's especially hard to know that he tried to burn our family to death while we slept. Shapiro, a Democrat, and his family were in the mansion when the attack occurred, but no one was injured. The arson attack took place on the first night of the Jewish holiday of Passover, and the family was hosting 15 overnight guests. Pennsylvania State Police banged on the door and woke the governor, his family, and guests who were asleep when the fire started. They fled the burning home, and it took firefighters about 20 minutes to extinguish the blaze. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Land move for Trump Library is blocked. A Florida court put on hold the transfer of land held by a Miami college for President Trump's presidential library, ruling that the college failed to provide reasonable public notice for its board vote to donate the land. The court's injunction Tuesday temporarily freezes the land transfer and represents a setback to Trump's plan to create a library on the 2.63 acres to commemorate his time in the White House. The Miami-Dade College land is now used as a parking lot. It is a prime downtown location and is estimated to be worth more than $67 million, according to county appraisers. The college last month voted to convey the land to the state, which then donated it toward the library. At issue is whether Miami-Dade College gave reasonable public notice of the meeting, where its board of trustees voted in favor of the land conveyance. In Florida, the state sunshine law requires public meetings of boards and commissions to be open to the public with proper notice given. Judge Mevel Ruiz of Florida's 11th Judicial Circuit said the court does not believe that the notice was reasonable. Critics of the land donation say that the land shouldn't be given away as a gift. Representatives for the college have said little publicly about the decision to transfer the land. At the hearing Tuesday, the judge said the college had the option to put out a new public notice and hold another meeting where the board could vote again, but the college said it is planning to appeal the judge's decision. Kirk gets Presidential Medal of Freedom. Slain conservative activist receives nation's highest civilian honor. President Trump on Tuesday honored the late conservative activist Charlie Kirk with the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian honor. We're here to honor and remember a fearless warrior for liberty, a beloved leader who galvanized the next generation like nobody I've ever seen before, said Trump. During the ceremony in the newly overhauled Rose Garden of the White House, Charles James Kirk was a visionary and one of the greatest figures of his generation. In his remarks, Trump compared the activist's sacrifice to former President Abraham Lincoln, the Greek philosopher Socrates, civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr., and the Apostle St. Peter. Charlie Kirk was a martyr for truth and freedom, Trump said. Those who change history the most, and he really did, have always risked their lives for causes they were put on earth to defend. Kirk, a father of two, was assassinated last month while speaking in Utah during the first stop of what was to be a fall college speaking tour. His widow, Erica, accepted the medal. He never told anyone what to say, she said, occasionally dabbing her eyes with a tissue as she spoke. He would encourage them to think outside of the traditional political labels. She said he probably would have run for president if he had lived longer. He lived every single second he lived, she said. She said he prayed for his enemies. I saw him do it, she said, stressing the importance of faith in his life. Kirk code attendees included Vice President J.D. Vance, who was close with Kirk, along with the president's son, Donald Trump Jr., and the members of Congress. The president walked out of the Oval Office with Erica and remarked it was the first time a public ceremony had been held in the Rose Garden since he paved it over this summer. Kirk co-founded Turning Point USA in 2012, a group aimed at spreading conservatism to young people. The organization embraced a free speech and political debate and sought to develop the next generation of conservative political talent. Several White House aides and Republican lawmakers got their start in politics through high school or college chapters of Kirk's organization and counted him as a friend. Kirk traveled to college campuses to make arguments against too much immigration and diversity policies and in support of traditional ideas of marriage. Clips of his debates went viral and reached students across the country who felt smothered by campus cultures where conservative viewpoints had few champions. Republicans have credited him with helping Trump gain ground with young men. In 2024, Trump won 57% of men under the age of 30, compared with 36% of those voters in 2020, according to exit polls. He also picked up support from young female voters, winning 41% of them in 2024, compared with 33% in 2020, the exit polls showed. Visas revoked over comments. The State Department said it has revoked the visas of at least six people for their comments on the death of conservative activist Charlie Kirk. The agency revoked visas from nationals of countries including Argentina, South Africa, and Mexico, the department said in a social media post Tuesday. The department didn't say if the people were in the country at the time their visas were revoked and didn't specify what kinds of visas they held or when the visas were revoked. In one screenshot shared by the agency, a person identified as an Argentine national said Kirk devoted his entire life spreading racist, xenophobic, misogynistic rhetoric. A German national wrote, "When fascists die, Democrats don't complain," according to the Post. "The United States has no obligation to host foreigners who wish death on Americans," the department said. Maine governor enters race for Collins' seat in Senate. Maine's Democratic Governor Janet Mills launched a bid to unseat GOP Senate Susan Collins in what is shaping up to be one of the most competitive Senate races next year. Mills, the first woman to serve both as governor and attorney general of Maine, was a top recruit for Senate Democrats as they make a long-shot effort to win back the Senate, or at least gain some seats. She is entering a crowded field with more than a half a dozen other declared Democratic candidates, aiming to capitalize on her name recognition and her public sparring with President Trump. "There are too many politicians in Washington, including Susan Collins, who have forgotten their principles and let bullies like Trump have their way, and it is hurting Maine people," Mills said in a video announcing her official campaign launch on Tuesday. Collins, a powerful chairwoman of the Senate Appropriations Committee who was first elected to the Senate in 1996, has proved to be tough to beat, despite heavy spending by Democratic challengers in the blue-leaning state. In 2020, she defeated Democrat Sarah Gideon by about 9 percentage points. Mills, age 77 years, could pose a stronger challenge if she becomes a Democratic nominee. She has served two terms as governor and recently clashed with Trump over the state's policies related to transgender athletes. As she kicks off her campaign, Mills is seeking to paint herself as the candidate who will stand up to the White House. Age is also part of the discussion as Mills enters the race against Collins, who is 72. Mills would be the oldest freshman senator if she won the race and took office. She told the Boston Globe she would only serve one term if elected. Republicans currently hold a 53-47 edge in the Senate, and Maine, along with North Carolina, are seen as Democrats' best chances for picking up seats. Cook Political Report, which tracks races nationwide, moved the Maine contest to toss-up from lean Republican after Mills' announcement. The announcement is no surprise after the campaign posted the video and then quickly deleted it on Friday, and it comes after months of speculation, which first began building over the viral moment where Trump confronted Mills in February at a gathering of the country's governors at the White House. Trump asked whether Mills was going to comply with his executive order related to transgender athletes. Mills replied that she would follow state and federal law. When Trump threatened to withhold federal funding if her state failed to comply, Mills said, "We will see you in court." A federal court judge ultimately ordered the administration to unfreeze federal funding for Maine's child nutrition programs in April. Mills didn't move quickly to launch a bid for Senate, leading other candidates to jump in. Graham Plattner, an oyster farmer and progressive candidate, has proved a strong fundraiser. Other candidates include Jordan Wood, who served as a former California Republican Katie Porter's top aide. Dan Klaban, who co-owns Maine Beer Company, said Tuesday he was suspending his campaign and endorsing Mills. The National Republican Senatorial Committee released a new digital ad ahead of Mills entering the race. Janet Mills wants to be the oldest freshman senator in American history after a record of failure that turned Maine into one of the weakest economies in New England, NRSC Communications Director Joanna Rodriguez said. Collins was among Republicans who voted against the GOP-led Obamacare repeal in 2017, and she sided with Democrats to try to convict Trump in his impeachment trial over the January 6, 2021 Capitol attack. U.S. Army plans to power bases with tiny nuclear reactors. The U.S. military is making one of its most significant pushes yet into modern nuclear power with a program to put small reactors on Army bases across much of the country where strained power grids can't keep up with rising energy demands. The Army on Tuesday unveiled the Janus program, which aims to supply bases by 2028 with microreactors, tiny reactors generating less than 20 megawatts of electricity, generally enough to power a small town. That is a fraction of the energy output that larger modern reactors can produce, but the microreactors are small enough to move on a container ship or aircraft. The reactors will help keep weapons powered and maintain critical base operations when other energy sources go down because of bad weather, cyber attacks, or other grid disruptions, the Army said. What resilience means to us is that we have power no matter what, 24/7, said Jeff Waxman, Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Army. The reactors will be owned and operated by commercial companies, although the Army and Energy Department will help with technical aspects and uranium fuel supply. The Army is in the process of selecting 9 bases for the initial phase of the program, and by next year we'll choose commercial vendors to rebuild 2 microreactors apiece for each base, Waxman said. Interest from the Army is promising opportunity for nuclear power startups that have raised billions of dollars for projects including small reactors, uranium enrichment, and new fuel technologies, but in many cases are years away from completing a product. The race today is actually to develop the capability. We are all trying to figure out who can turn these things on, said Isaiah Taylor, chief executive and founder of Valar Atomics, a microreactor startup. His 2-year-old company, which has built 1 micro-core reactor, plans to build on the Janus contract. Janus builds on more than 6 years of efforts by Army and Defense Innovation Unit, the arm of the Pentagon that works with technology startups to acquire small and easily transportable nuclear reactors for bases in the U.S. and military operations overseas. The program is intended in part to better prepare the U.S. for potential war with China in the Pacific or conflict in the Arctic, Army officials said, which would bring major transportation and logistical challenges for supplies, including power. Bases in Texas and California have lost power in snowstorms, and others rely on aging public utility grids and fossil fuels for backup. Solar and wind power are intermittent replacements. Meanwhile, many of the Army's newer weapons, including drones and counter-drone and radar systems, require more energy, a Defense Department official said. The nation's energy needs are soaring, driven in part by big tech's quest to build power-hungry data centers to develop artificial intelligence. China's own energy advancements have framed the race for nuclear power as a national security imperative. President Trump signed an executive order in May calling on the federal government to deploy modern nuclear reactors for national security purposes and asking the Secretary of the Army to start using reactors on military bases by September of 2028. The Army didn't provide a clear cost estimate for Janus, but said that some of the money would be pulled from the Defense Innovation Unit budget. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the October 15th issue of the Wall Street Journal. We read from the Wall Street Journal every Monday through Thursday at 11 p.m. Your reader has been Claudia, and I thank you for listening.
If you or people you know shop at any of the Dash's supermarkets, please save Dash's register tapes for radio reading. Our agency receives $2 for every $100 in Dash's register tapes. Radio reading has raised thousands of dollars so far. Anyone can drop off their Dash's tapes to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service at 1199 Harlem Road, Cheektowaga, between William and Clinton Streets. Or Dash's tapes can be mailed to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service at 1199 Harlem Road, Cheektowaga, New York, 14227. Any questions on Dash's tapes for radio reading? Call us at 716-821-5555, and thanks for caring.